Good morning.
How's it going?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Good. I'm excited for our podcast today. And it's a, I don't want to say it's a surprise guest. You know he's coming, but it's one who you haven't had the pleasure of working with before.
Exactly.
So I'm excited for you to get to know our guest.
And he's from across the pond. So
and he's from across the pond. So he sounds so much nicer than we do. Yes. Our listeners will be very, very happy not to hear our voices and have a different accent. So let's get to it. I'm excited because I think our guest is going to talk about, you know, the question of, you know, what if the reason that your transformation project fails has absolutely nothing to do with the technology?
Shocking.
Yeah, exactly. So today's guest has spent nearly two decades inside some of those most complex operational environments you can imagine, global supply chains, healthcare systems, enterprise ERP rollouts. He's seen the same pattern play out over and over again. The strategy looks terrific on paper. The system is selected. The budget is approved. And then somewhere it falls apart. So I'm excited to bring on Ryan Hardcastle. He is a transformation director. He's led business systems and change initiatives across industries where margin is razor thin. And what he'll tell you is what he's learned the hard way, as most of us do. Difference between a transformation that works and one that stalls almost always comes down to the same few things. Alignment across every level of the organization, and not just assumed alignment, but real alignment built through upfront, consistent, and sometimes uncomfortable conversations with all the stakeholders in the room. Culture. A culture where it is safe to surface problems early, because when people are afraid to flag what's broken, accountability disappears and your project goes poof.
Good time.
And then also his approach to a phased and gated way of leading transformation projects that lets you course correct before you've committed everything to a direction that may or may not work. So I'm super excited to bring Ryan into the room.
Awesome. Let's do it.
One, two, three, four. Hey, Ryan, we are so excited to have you on the show today.
Hey, thank you.
Conversation today is all about transformation. And I know that you've got a lot of experience with that subject and a lot of project leading up to it. And so I'm excited to get into the real practical element of what you've learned and what counsel you have for others when it comes to successful transformations.
Excellent. Thank you. Looking forward to it.
Cool. So I know that you've worked inside a couple of different worlds. So you've got global supply chain on one side, you've got healthcare technology along with some other options. But before we dig in, I'm wondering, just tell us, what does a transformation project feel like from the inside on
Day one can be two things, I guess. Day one can be we're going on a transformation journey. What do we want to do? What do we want to start with? What does success look like? And that's where I'd normally start day one. But for other people, day one can often be we've decided to go on a transformation journey and these are the deliverables and this is the project and we're off. But yeah, for me, definitely day one is we want to go on a journey. We want to transform. And what do we want to achieve? And day one is setting those expectations for me, definitely, rather than just going straight into delivery. It's making sure that everybody's aligned, everybody knows what we want to do and setting the scene and taking those baselines as well.
In your experience, what is the impetus for most people starting a transformation? Is it growth? Is it stagnation? Is it market pressure? Like, what are the real reasons why most people start transformations?
So most people tend to be it tends to be technology from what I've seen. They need to advance their technology. I mean, now is a prime time for that when people are wanting to move to cloud and then they want to move to AI and they're wanting to advance and make sure that they keep up with the times and they can integrate all of the new kind of innovative solutions within their enterprise systems. So that tends to be why people start, in my experience. And then they look at how is that going to save us money as we start to grow and expand.
Do you think that's the right place to start a transformation? Loaded question, I know.
Yeah, I guess. It all depends on where the organization is. I think if the organization is working on technology that is no longer supported, it probably is the right place to start, because that's the catalyst. You need to make sure that you're working on technology that can be supported. If your technology is still supported, I think the transformation should start from where do you want to be, what's the strategy, and then how do we put technology in place to support that strategy.
Yeah. Ryan, I know that you've had a nice position being able to see a transformation from both sides, because you're looking at it from the business point of view, what are the business objectives we're trying to achieve, and the technology point of view of, okay, now how do we build the system that underpins that process? I'm wondering, when you're looking at it, what do you think that IT sees that the business doesn't see, and vice versa? What does the business see that IT doesn't see?
So I think the IT will often see first and foremost will be security. It will be, is the system compliant? How does it integrate with our existing systems? And then also think, what does that mean for me as individuals supporting and as part of my career? So yeah. I think,
things that the business may not think about when they're looking at a shiny silver object saying, ooh, bells and whistles, what can I do?
This is it's a very shiny car, and then IT want to look under the hood, I think is probably the best way of putting it.
Right.
And I think from the business side, the business will see this could help us with revenue, this can help us, increase revenue, or we can increase our throughput while maintaining the same amount of cost in terms of labor, etc. So I think that's what the business will see and how it supports kind of the objectives and the strategy. So having the two come together is really important, but I think that's sometimes where the missing is.
Yeah,
and I think the point around like security, data, all those things, the business doesn't often associate IT with that, and often sees the bottleneck of IT, right? And we really have a strategic position in protecting the organization. And that's not really a message you hear often, and not even from CIOs often. I mean, they obviously would say it the most, but you don't really hear it from other C-level executives in this transformation space to say, well, wait a minute, guys, the reason IT is asking these questions is because we can't be vulnerable to threats. We can't have our customer data leaked. We can't have employees, having unauthorized access to areas of this company that they shouldn't have access to. What is your kind of guidance as you're leading a transformation on bridging that gap between both IT and the business?
I think from the very start, it would be understand what those questions are, what those guidance are, and involve them early. For me, it's something that has to be worked through, and very rarely do people enjoy working through it, because, as you said, Rich, it's seen as a bottleneck. But you need to work through it. You need to answer those questions. You need to make sure the data is protected. So engaging with those IT teams and making sure okay, I need to answer X, Y, and Z questions. So even when you're going through kind of software selection processes, you can start the ball rolling at that point and answer the questions. So then when you get everything approved, you're going into delivery mode, and you're not having to then start to address all of those questions.
I'm wondering, when a transformation stalls, what do you think is usually the what's happening underneath the facade here? What are the most common challenges you see?
Yeah, kind of the swan or the duck on the top of the water looking nice and calm with the legs burning underneath. So it tends to be, for me, what I've seen in the past is it's a misunderstanding. People are working very hard, and they're working for the objectives, and they're trying to get their piece of work done. But because they're focused on what they're doing, they miss the bigger picture sometimes. So people are kind of working in silos a little bit, and working over here and working over here and working here. But then you just need to make sure that you're all working on the same jigsaw.
Yeah.
We talk about the silos a lot, and it's literally my biggest frustration about corporate America is everybody's kind of heads down doing their things. And to your point, with the best intention to get their job done, where do you think that breakdown happens in terms of the silos? Do you think it's leadership? Do you think it's the transformation office? Like, where do you think that breaking of the silos happens? Because it happens very rarely, let's be honest. Like, and we just finished a project where we worked with a client for about 8 weeks doing a VibeFest, you know, AI rapid development. And each of the teams had to come together. And so part of the goal of the 8 weeks was you have to reach across the aisle. Like, you literally can't develop this product without it. But that was a very different thing because they were developing from the ground up. And well, that's not usually what we're doing. So how do you bridge that? Because that's a cultural thing. And sometimes, obviously, we're the outsiders in, right? We're not sitting inside the political machine, so to speak.
Yeah. And bringing everybody to the table is definitely having a shared purpose, having a forum where you can bring the business, IT, transformation, and you're all partnering with each other and you're talking about what we're working on, even if it's not talking about the problems, because there aren't any problems that week, still talk about what you're working on, because right. It might be that actually, oh, well, there's something that you're working on over here that I can right. help you with. I'm working on it and I've already done it over here, and you can kind of bring them together then. So just having a common forum where people can kind of talk for kind of 30 minutes, and I find that helps in the past.
And do you think your role as like a transformation leader is to engage those tough conversations when nobody will?
I'd like to think it's everybody's responsibility.
Yes, agree.
I will if other people want, because yeah, for sure, transformation can't be successful if everybody's not on board, everybody's not part of the journey. So yeah, definitely.
Well, I think we were talking before we recorded, just it's the tough conversations that make or break transformations sometimes, because those are the ugly real questions that need to be wrestled with. And sometimes you get to the middle of a project and realize, okay, those haven't happened at the right level and to the right detail. And I think that that's really painful. And I think a lot of times leaders don't want to hear that, because at some point in time, they're called to the carpet for, okay, we have to make a decision now. And you are the only person within this project who has the authority to make that decision. And that's uncomfortable to call out leaders sometimes.
Yes. Yes, it definitely is. But it's all about the framing of it as well. I think, you know, there's option A, there's option B. These are the risks. But yeah, it is very difficult and it can be very uncomfortable, but you need it to move forward.
Absolutely necessary. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. I'm wondering, you've lived inside of a lot of different systems. You've worked on a lot of different transformations. When somebody says, our systems are the problem, is that usually true? What do you think?
So I have a unique perspective on this, because I've also worked in support as well. So I've worked supporting systems that have been handed over, and I would say usually it can be the systems, it can be the configuration or a bug or something like that that's been handed for sure. But generally speaking, I find training, because when you're setting the budgets to deliver projects, the things commonly that I see getting trimmed, change and training. So if those two get trimmed, when you then deploy, who, you know, you have attrition. So the people that were there when the project went in, leave, somebody else comes in, I don't know where the system, they don't know, they think it's not working properly. Something gets raised with the IT system, IT team, and then, so it tends to be a little bit of training, I find, but stems from kind of that budget section, really.
And but that's an interesting point, because we see that all the time. I mean, for years, when I was at Accenture, the first budget line item, right, change management training. Oh, we can do it internally. Betty can do it. Okay, is Betty full-time? No, she's part-time. She has like 5 hours a week to do training. And you're like, you want to spend multi-millions of dollars on a brand new system and have Betty do training part-time. Sounds like a winning combination. But do you think it's an unrealistic expectation at the start of the transformation, or when the idea of the transformation from executives come up, the true cost of transformation, and not just the cost to do the transformation, but the ongoing cost, a true realistic budget of this is not going to cost $1 million to do the system. This is going to cost you X millions of dollars to do it right. And this is what right looks like.
Yeah. And that's where I think a gating approach can really help. And it's difficult because the first part is discovery and you want to do some discovery, but you don't get any benefit out of just doing discovery, especially if it doesn't move forward to the next stage. But in an ideal world, you do your discovery, and I've seen this work previously, but obviously you leave money out there because some projects you don't move forward, but you do your discovery and then you move into a phase B. And you say, this is what it's going to cost for this. And then you start to set it for, this is what it's going to cost to maintain. So you get more accurate with your estimates as you go along for like ongoing support, as you said. And when you want to deploy or prior to deploy, what's that training going to cost? You'll have more of an idea. So you get more solid estimates as you work through that gating process.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that. And I also appreciate because then you start to get a better sense of, okay, what does day two look like? Because we talk a lot about day two. Okay, right. We've got the shiny silver tool. Everything's beautiful. Now what? Who owns all of the, who owns adoption? And I think a lot of times, you know, again, we put these projects together and there's a sense of, okay, Betty's going to do training. Okay, but then that goes away. And adoption is a long-term, like we've got new people who are onboarded. That's a big element. And then we hope that these tools continue to evolve too. And so I think, you know, setting up that operating model in order to get a rhythm that continually adds to the stack, to your point, Rich, that you've spent millions of dollars on, is critical.
Where do you see the most common failure points for transformations?
So testing is one I find gets underestimated quite a lot. So there's usually an assumption that you're going to test things and most of it's going to work. There'll be a few small problems that need fixing and then you'll just go around and fix them and then off you go. So I find that when project timelines are put together for delivery of a transformation project, testing is usually one. I think even before you start setting the budget, because as we've just said, if training gets taken out, if I've seen before assumptions around we'll get a discount on licensing and hosting, so that goes into the budget, you don't see those come through. And then the project team are really trying to react because they're trying to deliver this project at the same time as reforecasting, rebudget, and put it back through the hopper. So yeah, those two areas, and then the transition into BAU support. So as you transition it to your support teams, a lot of the time the support teams are involved at the end, and then nobody's had time to do any documentation of all the fixes and how it was put together because they were heads down trying to get it to work and deliver to a timeline. And if you bring in those support teams early and they can work through it with you, then they can kind of transition it to BAU. So I think BAU, budget, and testing are the three for me.
Yeah, which is interesting when you talk about budget and support and bringing people in. Do you think they do a good job bringing the right people in, to your point, at the right time? So often there's not a finance person assigned to many projects that you work on, right? And to your point, budget is something that constantly gets revisited. So you may have that, oh, we're going to spend $2 million, that's your budget. But to your point is like, yeah, but as I work through this, that budget may flex up or may flex down. And like, we constantly kind of have to adjust that. And then the other point you made, which I think is super interesting, is when do we bring in people and when is the right time to bring in people? Because the traditional kind of waterfall, if you think about it, is, hey, we go off and we do requirements and then everybody goes away where we build a design. And then you come back together and we present you a design and everyone's like, yeah, it makes sense. And then years ago, it was 9 weeks of development and then test, right? Now, sprint and iterative makes it a little easier. But to your point, don't really identify all the people because they're peripheral to the project. So they're not thought of on the onset of a project. And it really does, to your point, affect the success or failure long term. So how do you kind of, do you have a disciplined approach to bringing the right people to the table and challenging when somebody may say, no, support doesn't need to be there. They're too busy. They don't have time to sit in on it. because that's the common, right? Everyone's too busy.
Yeah. And everybody's always busy. Mm-hmm. And if busy was an excuse. But yeah, I always like to have support in there early. Like if I could have them at design, I would. But usually it's as we step into testing and development and that iterative approach. And especially as you have kind of the wireframe sessions and the demo and the continuous iteration, because with kind of modern tools now, it's not like you said, 9 weeks of development, you can produce things quite easily and quite quickly that maybe doesn't have the finished, polished feel to it. But everybody can get a sense of where you're going and what it's going to look like. And then the support team can say, oh, but this here is going to be a problem for this site over here, because most things are global rollouts, whereas they'll work perfect for this large site. So having them in early and definitely during kind of that development test agile approach is where I like to bring them in.
Right. Nice.
It's really that I think kind of the misconception of IT is kind of a misconception about support is they really do know your customers, right? They hear from customers all day. They know the pain points. They resolve the pain points. So it is really, again, one of those untapped employee groups around the knowledge of your business.
Yeah. And they are good change advocates as well. They speak to the end users all the time. They have those working relationships, like you say, so they can spot things, but then they can also advocate for the system as well and say, oh, I've seen it. Actually looks really good. And they can share things. You know, it's easy to make a recording of something now and that you can disseminate across. So
yeah, 1,000%.
Talk to me about data, because I'm looking at you know, your background, supply chain, lots and lots of data. I mean, you've worked in healthcare, lots of data, different consequences for both of them, obviously. I'm wondering just as you move from industry to industry, what has changed as you look at data and as you say, what's good enough for data?
And I think that's interesting because good enough is often people don't say good enough. They say, oh, I want perfection before I start to use this data. And the beauty is that with the technologies we've got through kind of AI and machine learning and everything else now, it doesn't have to be perfect. And you can use those tools to help you identify where you've got gaps in your data because it's good enough, but you want to iterate on it to get it to the next level. So for me now, it's a lot easier to get to data that you can use and you can start to make data-driven decisions and get it to a point. Whereas even 5-6 years ago, it was more difficult to do that. You had to manually massage that data or transform it in a way that allowed it to be consumable. So yeah, I think that good enough data now is where somebody can kind of look at it and they can say, that makes sense to me when I'm reading that, and I can get 80% of my answers that I need from it. And then we can iterate on it to get to the next 20.
Nice. Yeah. I'm wondering, when you're looking at organizations, I mean, every organization wants to be data-driven, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are organizations that have data. And I think everybody thinks that they're data driven, but what are the differences that you see in the ones that are actually data driven?
I think data driven is when you use it every day and it's a habit and you use it in a structured approach. For me, that's what data driven is. You look at something and you say, okay, we've got this much in the pipeline that we could sell. This is what our outstanding open POs is looking like. So being able to look at that and answer those questions in a structured way all the time, that for me is data driven. Being able to frame questions and answer questions around it and get insights. Having data is when you kind of look at it and think, I think this is what it's telling me, but I'm not sure.
But if you're truly data driven, then that's also where the iteration comes in. Right?
Yeah.
Because you're really catching those gaps in your data. But it's incumbent on the leaders of the business to kind of define what that strategy is, which is often the gap, right? to your point, they look at the data and they say, oh, here's my pipeline. And we've all seen those leaders who will look at a number and say, that number is absolutely wrong. You're like, how do you know that? Because I know my business. I've been in this business a long time. I can tell you we didn't book $20 billion. Like, that's just impossible. Whereas there are other people who go, oh, okay, let me take that number and put it on a PowerPoint slide and move it down the chain. Where have you seen data-driven work really well? And an example of maybe where it just fails.
So the 20 million is a great example, because I've seen that where, and if it's data-driven, they'll look at that 20 million and they'll be able to dig into it and understand where that's coming from and be able to stand behind it. And I've seen that across, in healthcare and in kind of the supply chain industries, where people have been able to look at the data and they've been able to say, even support tickets as well, you can use that and you can say, okay, well, 60% of my support tickets, and this is something that we have done in the past, are creating new users. Well, that's ripe for automation. So maybe we can use that and we can automate that. So using that data, that's data driven for me. Taking 20 million and saying, I don't really agree with it, so I'm not going to use that. That's kind of having data, and like you say, it's definitely something that needs leading from the top down.
Yeah.
When you think about data failures, you've seen that, and it's different on, it means different things to different businesses. But I'm wondering, you mentioned with the support tickets, like that's a great place where, decision, you use the data and you determine, okay, this is going the right way or this is going the wrong way. I'm wondering, where do you typically see the breakdown in data? Is it the collection? Is it the transformation? Is it the structure? What do you typically see are the data problems, or where would you look in order to break it down and fix it?
So it tends to be, for me, I found that the data breakdown is normally in the trust in the data and the structuring. So If you see one bad data point or one thing that's not telling the story that you expect it, the data's bad and it's not telling the story that either you needed it to tell, or it's wrong, because usually it's been put into the source system wrong, and therefore people lose faith in it. And that is the hardest journey when you're going from not being data driven to being data driven. Is getting people to trust in that data set.
And it's interesting because we tell this story all the time. We had a CIO on who said, she was explaining to the other ELT members and the SLT that IT doesn't create data, guys. The systems that are in the business create the data. So sales, marketing, support, that's where the data is originated from, either from our customers or from an internal employee. So when you don't trust the data, it's not because somehow the CIO and their business unit decided to, let's manipulate this data for them. Let's change the data. No, it's because it's wrong from the source. So how do you kind of deal with that messaging with the business who, one, I mean, we all know sales would rather walk on glass than input data into a CRM, right? Or deal with that quality up front, because that's really where it starts.
Yeah. And again, having the data there and being able to go back and say, okay, well, this is the data, this is where it came from, this is a source system, then that allows you to be able to say, okay, well, if that's a source system and this is where the data came from, then this is who put the data in. So is the data wrong or is the data right? And it allows you to have a conversation around the data without any emotion in it. And I think, I think that's the key thing around data, is it's less emotive and it's more just following it back.
Yeah.
So
and a lot of it goes to the same. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, when you talk about that, this kind of goes to data governance, right? And where do you think data governance actually should sit? And do you think companies have a strong enough data governance model or data governance, accountability across those systems? You just said, here's the source system. So is somebody really working with sales on a regular basis, marketing on a regular basis? So kind of two, like, where do you think that sits? And then do you really think companies invest enough in that?
No is the short answer. However, I think data governance and the investment in governance kind of sits there with training and change management and kind of in that bucket of it's a bit intangible. So how are we going to justify it? I mean, having it, like we talked about with transformation and having that shared operating model where you've got, you know, the different elements of the business and you've got transformation and you've got IT in there. So kind of the same model where you've got IT and then you've got your different areas of the business and you've got that shared model where everybody understands how the data is used and where it's coming from and can hold each other to account. So then it becomes a discipline in itself. That would be the ideal. But again, it takes some investment and I've seen it done halfway, but I've never seen it fully implemented.
Yeah, it's a really tough one. And I think we see it all the time is going that circular reference. It's not to point fingers. It's to say, okay, where do the root problems lie? And what's the output then of that poor process, poor training, whatever it is that's now driving the downstream effects? And I think to your point on what makes good projects, a lot of it does come to that partnership. And that leadership and the leadership holding everybody accountable to the goals. I'm wondering, what are the leadership traits that you think do make the biggest difference, whether it's a transformation or whether it's, you know, the data governance that really make everything work?
So leadership traits.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely, like for sure, just being having the ability to listen and be empathetic. And understand that it's not going to be perfect and people make mistakes. I like people just learn from those mistakes and work on them. I think first and foremost, for me, that's kind of number one. I think second is the ability to make sure and hold everybody accountable to what they're responsible for. So yes, there was a mistake here. That's fine. Go and fix it. Have you fixed it? And just following up and making sure that, you know, you made a mistake, but you own the fix for it as well.
Yeah, accountability.
I love that about, go ahead.
Sorry, accountability becomes one of those words that has a negative connotation, but it really shouldn't, especially in the context of business when you're talking about, you know, providing a service, you're talking about accountability to stockholders or shareholders or a margin. Like it all often seems odd to me when people get held accountable that they find that to be negative or the wrong thing to do or rude. You know, I can't believe they told me I did that wrong. When it really is the basis for how we should be running businesses.
It is. But it also is the output of the first thing that you said, Ryan, which is making an environment that you can recognize that failure is not absolute, you know, failure. I just recently was reading about Sarah Blakely from Spanx, because she was saying that at her dinner table, that her parents would say on a weekly basis, "How'd you fail this week?" And they would celebrate their fails. And I thought, oh, like, what an amazing thing. As my kids are now in college. And I'm like, yeah, we never did that. And I'm still driving them on what you accomplish. But we do have to be in an environment, too, if we're going to be honest with each other. And if we are going to genuinely hold each other accountable, then we need to recognize that it will not be perfect. We do need to, you know, take those failures as, hey, great lesson learned. Let's move on from this and let's learn from it.
Yeah, especially because if you're scared of failing, you'll be scared of taking action.
And that's exactly right.
When you tie it back to transformation, your transformations are not going to be successful because people are scared to take an action because they don't fail and you get a vicious cycle.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Do you have an example of alignment that actually works? Like not the slide deck version, but the one that's day to day?
So I think we kind of touched on this before, but yeah, like alignment for me, it's not a slide deck. It's people coming together and talking and saying, well, I think this is going to be a problem for this reason, and then talking through it and everybody listening and saying, okay, yeah, I hear you. We need to solve that. Or in some cases, it's going to be that difficult conversation of, it's going to be challenging, but I think we can get through it. We're going to have to go in this direction because of this. Looking forward to working with you to help us work through it. And I think alignment is sometimes seen as everybody agreeing on everything, whereas I think sometimes alignment is everybody's aware of the direction you're going and why. And some people still won't agree with it. You all disagree in a room where it's appropriate, but then you all pull in the same direction when you start to execute. And I think that for me is alignment.
Yeah, I like that example because alignment doesn't need agreement, but it needs understanding. So if you want to operate your silo, at least you understand and you are fully aware of what's going on. So it's not out of ignorance you're making the decision, because we're bringing you along, we're taking you on this journey. So whether you feel it's the right time for your organization or whether you feel like it aligns with your organization's mission, like that's a completely separate conversation than this is how this is being operated and executed. And sometimes it's that, well, you got to get on board, or either on train or not on the train, right? Type of mentality, which really doesn't work in companies because it's not that cut and dry. It's not that black and white.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think, yeah, you need agreement. Agreement and alignment are different things, but I think they get confused sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so.
What do executives underestimate when they are kicking off a transformation? Are there things that you wish they would do every time?
So, I would like executives every time to be in the kickoff meeting. The programs and projects that I've been involved in that have been the most successful have been the ones where they've been there from the outset and said, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it, and really giving some context around it all and giving some weight to the program, the transformation, the importance of it as well. So I think that's super important to me, and I think that really helps kick things off and put it in the right framing. But yeah, that's the one big one for me. The other one would be probably back to budget and just making sure that we're all aligned on the budget, because things change. But going into something where the budget's not 100%, that often is one of the things that as you enter into projects, people are just reacting to, and it's not noise that people necessarily don't need.
I'm wondering if anybody is listening to this to the end, because we are at the end. What are, if you're sitting in a transformation project, it's stalled, what are your first moves when you're in that position?
My first
move. The data may be a mess. What do you recommend? What's your first move when you're in that situation?
Talk to everybody involved is why I always do. Because you'll hear one story from one side. So, you know, I often hear one from a technical perspective, but I want to make sure that I get the business perspective. And I also want to understand the testing and the training and kind of all the different areas that are involved in kind of the reason that the project or the program, the transformation is slipping, whatever it may be. So yeah, understanding the whole of it. But yeah, an understanding of the date, the new date. If somebody says it'll be okay next week, that sets alarm bells ringing for me. Because my next reaction is going to be, is that next week? And what's the reason? If this is slipping to next week, the person that is working on it, what else are they working on? So understanding the new date around it. So yeah, definitely understanding it all, and then understanding kind of the impact on the date or the budget, whichever it may be.
It's like you're reading my mind.
Right. Well, that's where those hard conversations then start surfacing. We haven't talked a lot about AI, which is unusual for us because usually all everybody wants to talk about. But be remiss if I didn't. How do you think AI, as it stands now, we obviously know it will change. How do you think that's impacting how you look at transformations going forward? You talked a little bit over the course of how it makes things easier, quicker, more iterative. But like, how do you think it changes, you know, your role as a transformation leader?
I think it's going to enhance it. I think that it's another tool that can be used first and foremost in where it is at the moment. It can help to bring an extra depth and level of thought process to business cases, to delivery, training, you know, the creation of training, being able to create those wireframes and those demos to get out there. We hear a lot about the vibe coding and all of that now. So, you know, I think it's going to help as a tool as it is now in all those different areas. I think moving forward, and I think this is true for AI in most areas of business, it's going to remove a lot of the back office work, and then you're going to be able to do a lot of the relationship. So you're going to be able to talk to people more because you're not having to do heads down work as much. You're going to be able to build those relationships. You look at sales, and we talked to, I think somebody said about CRM and not wanting to put all the data into CRM. I think that will go away more, and then you'll have salespeople being able to go out and work on relationships with customers more. Same for kind of the purchasing, buying, supply chain aspect of it. Be able to work on those relationships to get products in rather than being able to update the POs for the next delivery day. So I think that the world is going to be more around relationships and connections and being able to focus it around that.
Mm-hmm. On that subject, I'm wondering what either AI tools or podcasts or, you know, learning are you finding the most helpful? Because I think we're all kind of on this personal transformation with AI as well. What are you really enjoying right now?
So I've got a little bit more time on my hands at the moment. So I've started to actually use some more of the AI tools. So I've been using Claude a little bit to kind of just help me with my English as I'm writing things.
For sure.
But also I've actually been using Basically 4 to do a little bit of coding and app creation just to understand how it works. So that's kind of where I'm at the moment and why I'm using it. You know, it's interesting and it's quite intuitive as well. And yeah, very much.
I think that's the part that's most mind-blowing to me is it's intuitive. And then the product is insane in some cases. You're thinking, holy moly. Like, it's really incredible, which scares me as well, because what am I not seeing that's not so incredible?
That's it. And I think as you start to create these apps using the prompts, etc., there's still going to be an element of making sure that it's secure and that it adheres to all of the GDPR and all of the other requirements that you've got around security and personal data. So making sure that you give it enough context to understand all of that when you're creating those all things is really important. So
it goes full circle, doesn't it, to the beginning of what's the value of the IT mindset to the business?
Yeah.
It's all about, a lot of it is about risk management. It's risk management and enablement.
Well, and it's funny because I've been designing an app in Claude, and I reached out to a really good friend who's, you know, a developer and an architect. And I said, hey, I built this app that I want to use. And I said, how do I make sure it's secure? And I know to ask that because I've worked in IT and we've worked on transformations, but it is a little scary to think that any person now can build an app and put that app out there. And if they're really good marketers, somebody will start using that app and expose potential data that you don't want exposed. But you as a consumer don't have that security mindset. And you assume, and we are very trusting individuals nowadays when it comes to the latest app to download on our iPhones or, you know, on our computer or what app to use. And it's kind of like, as we get into this AI slop and all this other stuff, it is the warning that I don't think comes on the label.
Yeah.
You know, all AIs are not created equally.
That is true. And I think a lot of it as well, we went from kind of low-code citizen development to AI being able to create these apps very quickly. If there had been a little bit more time in between and people would have been able to get governance around citizen development a little bit more, that might have then transposed more easily to AI. But it's kind of, it's very difficult and, you know, a challenge to make sure that everybody's aware of, like you said, the security pieces.
Without the horror stories of whatever airline it is, you know, I'm trying to think of the ticketing when they were selling tickets for like a ridiculous number because AI had said, oh, this makes sense. I'm like, you hate to read those, but there will be more to come for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Good. Ryan, this has been really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. Excellent. And we will do it again. I'm looking to see where the next project lands, and you know who to bring in when you're there. Or at least let's get back together and compare notes, because I think we tend to see a lot of the same challenges, and it's always helpful to have an extra point of view and new ahas to consider.
Yeah, definitely.
Excellent. Yeah, excellent. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.